Okay, we're gonna get.
I can. Can you hear me? Okay.
We get the whole going here. I guess we're gonna start with the cash flow. What does it say here?
Investment analysis.
Yeah, an analysis of the cash flow discussion mainly.
Yep. And that's gonna be Addie.
Everybody hear me? All right. Here we go. So I'm just going to do a quick little introduction into what we're talking about tonight, and then I'm going to pass it off to Jim over at Ehlers here, who's going to provide us with some more detailed information. So, all right. So if you look at your packet, we've put together some graphs for you that start on page 5. They are included to help give us some background information for our discussion this evening. The data from these graphs was pulled from the past financial statements and annual budgets. The first graph shows the average cash to investments by year from 2018 to 2026, year to date, and shows how much this ratio has changed over the years. In years 21 through 22, we had the least amount invested because the interest rates for CDs was pretty low, around 0.05% at the lowest, so it just really wasn't worth it to have that money tied up in CDs. But once we hit 2023 and the interest rates started increasing again, the amount invested began to increase in tandem. So the next page then shows the amount of interest revenue that was budgeted compared with what was actually received. The same trends are seen here, where there was less revenue because the interest rates were so low in 21 and 22. 23 had a low budgeted amount due to the low interest rates when the budget was created, but the rates rose significantly during that year. Finally, the next three graphs show cash to investment trends, as well as revenue and expense amounts through the fiscal year of 2025. I used 25 for this presentation since it was the most recent full year of data that we have and kind of the most comparable, but I did analyze previous years and can confirm that they follow similar patterns due to how the cyclical nature of our cash flow is at Great River. So historically, while the amount of cash held in investments at any given point in the year is relatively consistent, there are certain times of the fiscal year where Great River has more cash on hand based on kind of significant revenues and expenses are realized. The cash to investment amounts by month, that's the next page on page 7, demonstrates this. The orange line is the amount invested, and the blue line is the amount of liquid cash. You can kind of see the ups and downs there. And those trends of the cash line are similar to patterns reflected on revenue graphs for 2025. If you turn to the next page, of course, it's a smaller amount proportionately, but those kind of trends of the ups and downs are present there. The first months of a quarter are always have an influx of cash due to signatory payments, $1.86 million each quarter in 2025. Additionally, RLBSS payments, over $500,000, are realized in February, September, and October, as well as a smaller amount in July. October has both signatory and RLBSS revenue payments. As for expenses, the following page, the fluctuations are less significant with the exceptions of the 2 months out of the year where there are three payrolls. So that would be May and October for last year's. So due to the cyclical nature of these revenues and expenses, there is room for maximizing the float, so to speak, or the extra cash on hand that is not needed for operations or designations at that moment in time. So while this money does remain in money markets, there are more profitable opportunities to maximize yield rates. So by working with Ehlers Financial, we have the opportunity to expand our investment strategies through the use of U.S. Treasury bills and notes, which are currently at a higher yield than a money market and comparable in terms of liquidity. So while Treasury bills are purchased much like bonds and CDs, they can be sold at any time and pose minimal risk to cash flow as they have no penalties. The only additional step required for cash flow risk management would be communicating with Ehlers about our cash flow needs and transferring funds to our operational accounts as needed. So since Ehlers specializes in governmental organizations, they can effectively minimize the risk to ensure the safety of invested public dollars. I know that was really fast, but I just wanted to get us over to Jim here. So
that was really great, Addie. I don't know if there's really much for me
Hold
to
on,
add. You did such a great job.
We got to turn you up so we can hear you on
okay,
the speakers.
Great. Hey, thanks. Sure, no problem at all.
start talking.
Can everyone hear me okay? Is that testing?
There we go. Now we can hear you.
All right. Great. Yeah, thanks so much. And thank you for such a great introduction, Addy. If it doesn't work out with the library folks, you may have a career in public finance investment. So, but truly, really grateful to Addy and her team, for the opportunity and all the work that, she put in to get us those numbers for, as you see in the cash flows are really helpful. So, yeah, really kind of what we're talking about today is, essentially just efficiently managing the GRRL's funds for the benefit of all stakeholders. So given where we were historically, short-term interest rates or money market funds had been paying considerably more than, longer-term bonds, which it makes sense to have funds. That's why you saw the big spikes in, 23, 24, in revenues because of those elevated short-term rates. So that has really shifted in the past, 6 months or so. And we've seen, short-term rates, stay the same while longer-term rates have moved up. So, essentially, just by moving out the yield curve a little bit further. So, what we would propose is investing funds for 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, whatever time frame we had agreed upon, just to take advantage of those higher rates and get a little bit of extra income for the library district. So it also is worth noting, I think, that short-term rates are kind of like your riskiest, most unknown return. So cash can have a really volatile return. So as we saw during COVID, having all of your funds or a bulk of your funds short term and not invested out in maybe a ladder type investment portfolio, that there's a big risk of those cash flows drying up. And so what we're proposing is an investment plan that supports the Great River's short term liquidity needs and also allows for income that you will realize that you can use for budgeting purposes because you know it's going to be there. And so that's really kind of what we do for a lot of our clients. And as Addy had mentioned, all of Eller's clients are municipalities or, special districts. So library districts, fire districts, and all we do is public finance. So we do all the adherence to 118A Minnesota State Statute for Addy and her team's benefit, and really, essentially, it would be like adding a staff member without having to pay for all of these things. So Addy will be my boss if we decide to move forward with this, but I want to make sure that any questions that anyone has are able to be addressed. This is your time. And so I just wanted to kind of do a little bit of landscape there. And to just note that, with the longer term rates moving higher, if we were to allocate, if you had about $7.5 million invested and $2.5 million in cash, earning a competitive rate of return, you'd be looking at about $400,000 in interest income per year. And that would be an amount that you could budget for in future years as well. So we can kind of reduce some of the volatility associated with just pure cash investments and or, cash equivalent money market LGIP type funds. So that's really kind of what we're proposing, and Eller's is a fiduciary, which means that we're legally required to act in Great River's best interest at all times. It's the highest standard of care for an investment advisor. And we're SEC registered, which means we have the highest level of scrutiny and audits and all that. So additionally, it is an at-will agreement, meaning that if at any time you're not satisfied with the service or for any other reason whatsoever, that contract can be severed at any time without any cost or minimum. There's no minimum fee. There's no minimum period of time or minimum investment amount. It's incredibly one-sided in the client's favor, and that's exactly how we prefer it to be.
I guess I'll open it up for any questions while we have Jim on the line here.
Anybody have any questions? I know Wright County uses them, mm-hmm. and everything's working good.
Very
there.
Happy with their services. Absolutely, it's our return on investment has been very well.
Significantly more than before.
Okay. And we're using them on our Justice Center project.
You are using them what?
On our big project.
Okay. Yeah. So they're taking Center. Your collection and putting it into investments for when you start to have to pay. I guess I do like that they're an at-will. So if you don't like them tomorrow, you could fire them.
Mm-hmm. Or if the board changes and has a different mm-hmm. direction. Yeah. I mean, there's just a lot of things and variables that could happen.
Yeah.
But I'll just say they've been consistent. Even back when I was a mayor a long time ago, we utilized Ehlers.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Anything else? Anybody?
So one of the questions that Addie and I have for the board, just to help us get started with this, because doing the float investment is new, is like how much does the board want us, how conservative do you want us to be, or do you want us to use whatever float we can, or a portion of it, or, you know, if you understand kind of what I'm asking there, just in terms of, do you want us to just go all in and see what we can get, or be more a little more cautious?
What's the recommendation?
All right. Jim.
Sorry.
What's the recommendation?
All right, Jim, I don't know if you could hear that, but we have a question about what you might recommend starting with for kind of this float investment strategy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I think a good kind of maybe starting point would be maybe $5 million and then see if that is a comfortable amount. And I'm using that really kind of being ultra conservative around the cash flow estimates that Addie had put together. So that would lead to kind of probably an excess of cash at first. I think I measured kind of between the highest and the lowest cash reserve position. Looked to be and I would include both, you know, any investments you're holding outside of Ehlers as well as whatever you invest with Ehlers in the same kind of quote unquote bucket. Mm-hmm. I think that would be maybe a good kind of like toe dip or entry point to see how things work and make sure that you're comfortable with the process, and then and then from there, make adjustments as far as, you know, are we doing much better in the investment market than we are in the you know, money market funds, and then kind of changing those allocations. I think you could go as high as 7.5 total.
You mean
based on
in terms of like total investments between CDs and every
yep.
that whole, okay.
Mm-hmm. I think you could, based on those cash flows that you had shown, mm-hmm. I think you would still have a decent amount of wiggle room. And I would also mention that, like you said, the bulk of these securities are going to be incredibly liquid. And so it's not like if you needed money, you wouldn't be able to get it or you would pay a penalty. It's not like a CD or anything like that. Although we can buy CDs if that's something you wanted to do. Statute 118A is very restrictive, and And so there's not a lot of room for, like, quote-unquote risky investments in there. So these are all very safe, very kind of almost bordering on boring investments. So, but that's the name of the game is don't lose, you know, safety of principal, liquidity, and try to earn as much as you can from a yield perspective as well. So I think 5 would be a comfortable number. I think you could go as high as 7.5.
7.5. Okay.
Can I ask a question? I don't know if you can. Can you can you hear if we ask a question through the mic here or no?
If not, Addie can.
Yeah, I can just repeat any questions.
So what is there any downside to going all in $7.5 million? Your cash is safe. This is not a stock that can go down in value. The worst that can happen is you thought interest were going to make you, I don't know, $1 million, and it made you $800,000. Okay, big deal. Why lose on that potential interest revenue if there is no risk? Why? What would be the reason not to go in as $7.5 million if we're comfortable that it's liquid and we have enough cash on hand to meet our?
Yeah, so we have a question. Is there a downside to, like, just going all in with that $7.5 million, especially if we're averaging already for 2026 year-to-date about $6.6 million in investments between CDs and everything?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could very comfortably do that. I think the only thing that would really be an issue would be, like, that I don't think we would run into would be if we did a really poor job of communicating and planning the investments and bought some things that, were longer term in nature and you had to sell because of some sort of, like, your funding didn't come in or something like that, you know, like the dollar amounts that you get from, you know, from various sources throughout the year. If that stopped, that would be, we might have to sell something that we don't want to sell. But I think as long as we're communicating about liquidity needs, I don't see any major reason to not, you know, have the bulk of the funds working and earning as much as they possibly can. And we can have, of that dollar amount, we can have any amount in short-term U.S. treasuries that we could turn around and sell and get your money in 2 days. So really, the timing for getting funds from us is 2 to 3 business days from the time you say, send me some money, to the time it's in your bank account.
All right. Sounds good.
Mm-hmm. Quick question. So we still have money in CDs.
Yes. Correct, right. Yes.
So that's going to take a time. We can't just go all in because those
correct.
Have to mature, yeah. And then we can invest as we move forward.
Yeah, so how I'm seeing it, like, if you look back to my average cash to investments by year on page 5, mm-hmm. The year-to-date average for 2026, you know, is about $6.6 million invested, and I think pretty much almost all of that is CDs. There might be a few bonds at this point, but so really we only have about, you know, $900,000 to play with at this point, and we'd
right.
start small, so...
Yep.
So yes, most
it's
of that's
gonna take time.
Yeah, it's going to take time. So,
step into it.
And if those, you know, if those yields are proving to be more profitable, then we'll kind of switch more that route kind of
yep.
thing. So,
yep, I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that'll make sense.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So who would he work with? Who would Ehlers work with on our side of the library, the finance committee, or Addie, or who would we work with beyond?
Yeah. So Jim, the question is, who would you be working with? The finance committee, the board, me, Brandy. I think the answer is kind of all of us, probably.
Mm-hmm.
We would bring forth a more mm-hmm. formal proposal for this at a future board meeting. So.
Yeah, primarily you and Brandy,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and then reporting to the board or the finance committee as needed or requested.
So you perhaps bringing it back through the finance committee and then to the
yeah.
board would be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
agreed. Yeah, I guess kind of the purpose tonight is just see what you all thought. So.
Anything else?
Just one more question. And just to be clear, the purpose of this is so that if we can
capitalize on our investments and our cash, we can then, in turn, reduce our signatories.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's
yes.
what the purpose mm-hmm. of this
That is correct, yeah. And so, you know, we're already making a substantial amount on our interest revenue, as you can see from the page 6 graph. Mm-hmm. But just can we make an extra $50,000 just to really help, you know, with that year-to-year change? So. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, if there's nothing else, we'll let Jim get back to his day. So.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it. Hope everyone has a good evening.
Thank you. Thanks, Jim. Everyone says thank you. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Then Addie and I can work on putting together a specific proposal that we can bring back to the Finance Committee next month. And we can get moving on this, which, mm-hmm. again, super exciting. I appreciate very much the board's willingness to kind of let us try to find a few more pennies just to support our signatories and that in whatever way we can. So thank you for your faith in us. As two newbies to our roles, we appreciate it very much. And it's really, I will say for myself, being able to know we have Ellers on speed dial if needed, it just really helps to know that we have their support and their advice to use.
Well, I mean, they seem very workable at mm-hmm. 2 to 3 business days to get if you really got in a bind.
And can I add too? You're going to have more time to do other things as they manage it. Honestly, it's really transformed our finance department.
That's wonderful to hear.
Yeah, it's just really freed up for other projects to get mm-hmm. done. And so, yeah, that was one thing that you find out kind of later, like. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
If you're not calling the bank and trying to, talk to someone who needs to get that CD with that number, you're not doing that work mm-hmm. on an ongoing basis. They are.
So does awesome. Ellers charge us like a contracted fee amount a month, or how do they get their money?
I think it's like there's a brokerage fee that comes kind of out of our, it's all part of our monthly statement with them. It's available on all of our Ellers statements, though, so we know exactly what they charge, and it kind of comes out as negative interest, essentially, within our financial statements.
I think everybody's kind of in agreement that let them pick it up and present back to the board. And
awesome.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Next one is artificial intelligence policy discussion.
Okay, artificial AI intelligence.
All right, so our leadership team, we've been doing a lot of talking about artificial intelligence. It is a reality. It's here whether we want it to be or not. And Jay is here tonight to also help with answering any questions that people might have. But basically, in thinking about a policy for artificial intelligence with Great River Regional Library, my big concern in kind of how I approach this is that we can't know what our needs are going to be or what the specific applications are right now. But I want to make sure that whatever ways we do use artificial intelligence are absolutely grounded in ethics around privacy, around public accountability, and those kinds of things to make sure that as we're moving forward and finding and talking about ways to actually apply artificial intelligence and use it in our processes, that the first question is always, does this meet our ethics? And if it meets our ethics, we can move forward. But if it doesn't meet our ethics, then we stop. And ways that this has come up recently is, for example, we had to migrate our donor software to Bloomerang. And so when we were at the meeting with the representatives about Bloomerang, they were very excited to show us all the new things that Bloomerang does. And it was like, and this is Penny. She's your AI assistant who can help you out. And I said, nope, turn Penny off. because we don't even want to get into discussion of do we want Penny until we know what are our ethical ground, what are our ethical bases that Penny has to meet so that we can just have that stability and that solidity. Jay and I have tossed around some ideas of ways that we might be able to talk about or to use AI that would be, I think, a benefit to the library as supports for training staff, for helping with different kinds of document processing and development, but not in a way that replaces humans, in a way that helps humans be more effective in their work. Harvard Business Review came out with a great article. I'd be happy to share it with you all, because it's basically automation versus augmentation. So automation of AI, basically you use AI to replace people so you can lay them off and you spend less on people, versus augmentation, which is what I really want us to do, is where you use AI to help build the capacity for humans to do things that only humans can do. The really good public service, the critical decision-making, the creativity, and things like that. And that's more where I see us going. And so I used a lot of different things that I've been reading, studying, talking with Jay, talking with other regional directors to put together the ethical framework for use of artificial intelligence that you have in your work packet that kind of outlines some of those ethical points that I think are really, really important. And what I would like to come out of the meeting tonight with is knowing from you getting your kind of feedback on that practice or on that perspective. And then if I can get good feedback from you and direction, then to come back in September with an AI policy that is basically ethical statements. And this is the framework we follow. And then following that, once we have an AI policy, I'd like to put together a staff work group to basically say, okay, now using these ethical frameworks, thinking about this from an augmentation perspective, how can we use AI, or what are the ways of using AI for the library that would make sense for us, and what are the ways that we say no to? So that's kind of my big vision. Jay and I have also talked about going around and having some small group meetings around the region to talk to staff directly. We know a lot of staff have real fears about AI, and we want to be able to really invest in that communication with staff, both through a staff work group and also with the small group meetings and that. But again, starting from a place of this is what we believe, and these are our foundational ethics. Jay, anything that you want to add to my babbling? Okay. All right. So basically with this, I listed out the purpose to make sure that we stay focused on our mission and our vision statements, and then the guiding principles of what AI tools should do, such as be used only if there's a clear line with the purpose of the mission vision, be used responsibly, assist in the pursuit of the public good, things like that. And that they should not replace critical decision-making. And I put this one in, and I feel very strongly about it, particularly in regards to employment, financial, or legal processes or policies. Again, those areas where I think critical decision-making and the ability to understand nuance and perspective is really important. They should not be used for data that's privileged, private, or confidential, where libraries' privacy is a foundation of what we do, and so any use of AI needs to protect privacy. And not be used for original content creation that could replace or undermine the work of staff. And then also, any staff using AI tools should treat AI-generated content or data sets as drafts. This was something that I saw in pretty much everything that I read from a perspective of this is how it should be used well, and really make sure that staff know if they do use AI to develop content that that's a draft. That's to get you started. It's not your end product. And I will say I have done this and used AI in this way, in a way that really helps me get started thinking. So, for example, one of the things that I see Great River really needing is a social media strategy. Because right now, with our social media, we don't have a lot of resources to put it. We have very few staff hours at a regional level actually dedicated to social media. But staff around the region are trying to basically cover all bases and inspire all audiences. I have no idea how to do a social media strategy. So I asked Perplexity, what would a social media strategy for a public library that was focused on parents of young children look like? And I just threw in a few more things, and it gave me something that at least helped me start going, oh, I need to think about this and this and this and this. It's not that I'm using that as my strategy, but it really assisted me because I don't have time to go read a book about it. It really helped me see, here's 7 points that I really need to think about if I'm thinking about this strategy. So I think for me personally, I see that as an effective way to use AI because it can help you know where to start without scrambling or without having to read a lot of books. Keep in mind, I'm a librarian. I love doing research. I would happily go down a rabbit hole, but I don't have time for all those rabbit holes. So AI can help bridge that for me. And so that is part of the ethic that I bring to that. But it has to be considered a starting point, a draft. It is not the final product. We also need to review it for any factual errors, biases, breaches of copyright. And again, with Public Library, foundational ethics is that we are here for everybody. We provide equity, access, and inclusion for everyone, regardless of who they are or where they come from, what their background is, where they work, where they pray, anything like that. And so anything that we use AI for has to also follow that same ethic of access and inclusion. Okay. And then also I put in here being transparent about the use of any AI-generated content. I don't want someone pretending that what they're putting out there is not AI.
Usually you can tell.
Mm-hmm. Right? But it's going to get smarter.
Yeah, it'll get better. Yeah,
it's going to get smarter. I also put something in here of making use of work accounts instead of personal accounts. So if staff are using AI in some way to do their job, they should not be, say, creating a Perplexity account using their personal email. It should be used with their work email so that it's their work account. And opting out of shared learning if we don't know what all is being used for that. And then finally, again, going back to Penny, any third-party vendor software, if it has AI in it, we need to know that it is meeting our privacy expectations and other expectations. And that we should also provide programming and information to our public so that they're in a better position to make good, smart, informed choices about AI, recognize the impact it might have. And then also to try to stay nimble because the technology is expanding and growing at such a rapid rate. I don't want us to pretend that we can create a policy this year that in and of itself is going to be all that we need for the next 5. So in a nutshell, that is the document that I have, and I'm very open to your feedback. One other thing I should say, Traverse de Sioux Regional Library System, they also have a AI policy that is like this. It's just foundational ethics. Any use of AI has to meet these ethics for us to consider using it. So I used their document and also chatted with the executive director there. Yeah. Thoughts?
Yeah.
Does it sound like the right direction that you want me to go in?
I would suggest that you have someone on staff, and maybe it's Jay, that is on top of this. It's changing so fast that you need someone that is sort of in charge of the library and AI. Not that everyone isn't obviously in charge of it, but I just think it's moving so fast that I think you need a dedicated person that keeps a watchful eye on it.
Okay, thank you.
A question, like, would the employee be able to create any account under their work account of all the different AIs that are out there? Like, or would we just designate which ones would be accessible from a work email? I don't know. I'm just kind of
I don't know enough about the specifics there to say. Mm-hmm. I just know that I don't want them using a personal account for their work.
Yeah.
Jay, anything you would add to that?
We don't even know where we're going yet. We're starting we're starting with ethics.
Yeah.
We don't know where AI is going. Exactly. Brandy and I have discussed at length that we need now is our AI policy version 1. And then probably every year we're going to be coming back to expand on it, adjust it.
Yeah.
You don't see some policies for 3 years at a time maybe, but I'm guessing you'll be seeing some AI policy at least every year for a little while. We're just starting with ethics. And a lot of that, too, comes from one of our vendors, Circe Dynex. They have an AI policy, and theirs is heavy, heavy, heavy on ethics because that's what they wanted to put first as a library vendor is ethics first, and then what can we do with it? And that's we're taking a similar approach.
Yes.
It's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate what you both were just saying. I know for our county, it's done under our CIO. We do have a policy. It will probably evolve over time. We use Outlook. We have Copilot training as part of it. There are other ones. We also, to try to deal with some of our workforce issues, because we actually can't afford, nor can we find all the people we need. We're using, some of you have heard it, we're using something called Eva, which is a phone-based system, and she does actually sound like a person. She's crawling. She's learning. She can help with some things. Our sheriff's department's using something through Tyler that helps them know where everybody, all the first responders are. I mean, there's a whole lot of tools that can be helpful. Crunching data can be helpful. So starting with ethics, it seems to make a lot of sense. And odds are there's already AI because, right, there's, I mean, it's already embedded in some of the things that everybody's using. So thinking about how those tools work, where do they help, what doesn't work, and, you know, if it's getting, the prompts seem to be such a big part of all this, how are we making sure that it's only using the source, you know, the sources we want, among other things. So it sounds like a very prudent, you know, step forward.
Thank you.
No, I would suggest that maybe after the work is done on putting the ethical framework and the guidelines and all of that, maybe putting together a kind of a focus group that meets annually comprised of young teenagers, 14, 15, things like that, because the speed with which this thing is moving and the constant change that's happening with this, I mean, I hear from my kids things that are just mind-blowing about what they're doing on AI and what they're seeing on AI, and it's things I could never even think of or imagine. I think it would be helpful to have folks who are constantly using AI and maybe even to give some guidance towards, hey, you didn't think about this ethical stuff, but, you know, my friend is, like, getting crypto on AI and doing this and that.
So to that point, I mean, I love that idea. It's an and. The products we're probably using aren't things that any of our kids or my kids, grandkids are going to use. I'm wondering about use cases. Where does that come in the development? Because I'm guessing that's something that we'll see at some point. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it you're actually looking for, you know, for it to do? But maybe, maybe our youth council can
do something
too. Yeah. It wouldn't be the stuff at least my head's thinking about, but I think that's a really cool idea.
Mm-hmm. To kind of piggyback off that too, I like the idea on here of just having maybe some meetings with staff to talk to them about what AI and if we're going to be using AI at the library and what's acceptable. But that would also be a good way to talk to them, I think, about how to educate patrons too, because I think a lot of patrons are also concerned about AI, and so giving them those tools to speak with patrons about what to be careful about, what to look out for, what some safety precautions you can use when you're using AI, those types of things. And that might play into a little bit having some of those uses that maybe we wouldn't use at the library, but that people will run across often. Yeah.
Sure. So a couple things along those points, again, that Jay and I have talked about. Because the library, core value for the library providing reliable information, accurate, reliable information. And so Beth Ringsmith-Stoltman, our patron services specialist, she has put a couple articles out on the staff intranet about how to avoid AI hallucinations and problems in internet searches. When Jay and I have talked about the possibility of making our default browser for staff internet stations be something that does not have AI in it, because Google does. So something like DuckDuckGo, which I've been experimenting with on my computer to ensure that we don't have that. And next week we have a regional staff meeting where we'll have all the coordinators here, and they've all been assigned three separate trainings about AI and using it with the public, AI and privacy, those kinds of things. And so we will have a session to talk about what they've learned. So we already got in motion trying to educate staff to have a little bit more knowledge about those things. One of the other use cases that I have told Jay I really, really want, and he's been very good about trying to figure out a way to make it, is to basically try to create our own database of Great River Regional Library information, so like our own internal Google, so that has our policies, our procedures, our best practices documents, so that staff could type into it, what do I do when X happens? And it will go in and it will search for that information just with our documents. And so one of the biggest challenges that our public services staff have is how much they have to learn just to try to serve the public, because it is a huge job. You have the software in and of itself that's challenging, and then all the things that the public could ask about, and you've got to try to figure that out. And so it is a real challenge for staff to learn, what do I do in this situation versus that situation? How do I fix this kind of account issue versus that? Is this according to policy? Is that not policy? So if we had a way that we could have, like, a Great River database using AI to pull those answers out for staff more quickly and accurately, that would be really, I think, revolutionary for how our staff are able to interact with the public, how they're able to learn how to do things. Jay tells me it will need some stuff, but we will. That is one of the goals, is to get to a point where we have something like that, where we're using AI in ways that really support staff and support our public and support our mission.
In a lot of ways, AI feels free, because it happens when you do a Google search. It happens when you do email, maybe. But the reality is, to keep a private, confidential AI that doesn't go out to the public world, it's not going to be free. I don't know what it's going to cost yet, but it's not going to be free to do something that where we can keep confidential business information.
Those are some of the ideas that are percolating. We just want to take care of things while we get there.
Yeah, I like the ethical foundation. That's a very good start.
Awesome.
Working on it, bring it in gradually, and expand over time. And then ultimately we'll have to decide whether or not the robots get cards.
Right.
That's a ways down the line. But, I mean, just as long as we get into this cautiously.
Can we use them to count for our families?
I'm thinking.
Awesome.
Anything else on that?
No. If you have thoughts later,
you know, just email me directly.
Okay. 2026 Library Development Plan and Policy Discussion.
All right. So that's me again. So we have a meeting next week of the Library Development Plan Committee, and we've done a lot of work. We've been looking at some alternative services and things like that. But there's some pieces that, in order to make good recommendations to bring before you in a work session in October, it would be helpful for me to get a sense of kind of what you're looking for or what your comfort level would be with a couple of questions. So the way that the, just to back up, the library development plan, what that is it provides information about specific facilities, what's working well in the facility, and what's not working well in the facility. It also provides information about alternative services. So what are other ways that we could provide library services other than a brick-and-mortar building within a community? So some alternative services that we've had right now, the Sartell locker system is an alternative service. They don't have a brick-and-mortar library, but they have a locker. And the agreement that was established with Sartell is that basically they paid for it. And we look at the price for staff to go out and fill it and other things like that. And Sartell pays for that. And many of the alternative services that are in the current draft of the Library Development Plan have stipulations that this alternative service would be available in a location that doesn't have a library, and or this is available if the community wants to pay for it. And where I'm kind of stuck is in looking at a couple of our communities that have very small libraries in very small towns where the communities are really struggling to maintain the building, where we have significant and recurring issues of water intrusion or other kinds of things that have the potential to create health and safety hazards for patrons and staff. And so as I'm looking at this library development plan update and thinking about that, I'm thinking about those communities, and I don't know if it is realistic to imagine that that very small city is going to be able to raise a couple million dollars for a new library. And so are there things that we can offer them instead if that facility gets to a point where it's no longer safe? In talking with other regional directors at the CRPSLA meeting in Traverse des Sioux, I believe, and a couple other locations, they're looking at just outright closing those really tiny libraries, because this is an issue that's happening statewide where you have little towns that can't afford to maintain their buildings, and so they're looking at closing them. And maybe that is just what needs to happen, but maybe it's not. Maybe there's alternatives. Maybe instead there's a locker system there. But then if the city can't afford to fix the building, can they afford to pay for a locker? You know, they are investing a little bit in the current facility they have, so there's a cost sharing. But should there be some element of cost sharing if they can't maintain a library? The other question comes when you have within the current plan multiple places where it says this alternative service is only available for communities that do not have a library. But that becomes restrictive as well when you are thinking about some of our underserved populations. So, for example, I know we have had staff, local staff all over the region who've been trying for decades to figure out a way to provide access and services for seniors in assisted living facilities and other places like that. And what I've seen happen over and over and over is that you'll have a local coordinator who connects with an activity manager at an assisted living space, and they just start getting things going, and then one or the other turns over, and
you have to start over from scratch, and it's 3 to 5 years before you get that momentum. In some of the other state library, regional library systems, they do kind of outreach, where it's not exactly a bookmobile, but it's a van full of a curated collection that goes out and has designated stops, and they stop off at community centers and assisted living facilities and places like that, so that those residents or people can come in and they can check out books, they can turn in books, they can get assistance with technology devices and all those other kinds of things. So they basically take the library on the road, which may or may not be the kind of alternative service that could really help provide access to some of those marginalized, underserved populations we have in our communities. But again, the current library development plan says this service is for a community that doesn't have a library. And so that is where my question is coming to you, just so we have direction when we meet next week and when we start putting this together. Is there any appetite for loosening that restriction in those kinds of areas? Do you want to maintain that? Do you want to loosen it? And I want to be fully transparent that with some of this, there's some really big strings attached. So, for example, if we had a small town that has a library now, but they can't afford to maintain it or replace it, and we wanted to say, well, maybe we could do a locker system in your city hall, and we can do a cost sharing. And that might be a great idea. The strings there, or the tails there, is that our contract with Sartell is up next year. And if we're going to continue providing locker services in Sartell, we're going to have to talk with them. And right now, we do not have that kind of a cost-sharing agreement with them. And so is that going to make it messy if we say, well, maybe we'd be open to it in this little town, but not Sartell? So I want to be transparent that I don't think it's an easy answer, but that's why I wanted to just kind of pose some of these questions and find out if any of you have thoughts, or if you just want us to go forward and say, put it in there and we'll talk about it in October, or don't put it in there. You know, that's basically the kind of direction that I think our committee really needs right now.
So do you think that we have communities that are going to reach that point sooner than later?
I would not be surprised if within the next 3 years we have a community where we have significant mold problems in the library because of repeated water intrusion.
I like the locker system. I mean, Amazon has it. There's a reason. You can go at midnight and go pick up your book if that's mm-hmm. what your shift is when you're done working, mm-hmm. right? Like, I don't know that you have to qualify it for a small town. Mm-hmm. If someone wants to buy it for their community and their library system, great. Mm-hmm. We're going there anyway. I think more is better, and it's mm-hmm. partnership and coming up probably with a different policy. Mm-hmm. But that don't change it till you have those conversations.
Right.
You know, because I don't know how much luck costs. No idea. So
it'll be over $100,000.
What?
And Sartell's right now is on a lease, and the vendor no longer offers a lease, so when that needs to be replaced, it will be a capital expense for somebody if it's to continue.
Is there options? I mean, that's a lot.
But for the size that Sartell has, you could strip away pieces of it, and mm-hmm. the cost will come down, but when you strip pieces away, now you have fewer lockers. And we already have an issue where Sartell is at carrying capacity for the number of lockers they have. To meet demand, they really ought to have more, but then that's more expense.
And is the city's picking up that cost right now, right?
For Sartell.
Is it a one-time cost or ongoing?
So right now it's a lease, so it's ongoing, but it'll be a capital expense with a maintenance contract, which a maintenance contract be ongoing. You know, both capital, you have to replace it every however many years the vendor says that the equipment is good for.
Are there more than one vendor out there?
There's a couple. Yeah. The vendor we have is the one where it integrates with our catalog, so that the items are not checked out to you until you actually go open the locker and take the stuff. There's other vendors where we check stuff out to people and then put it in the locker, and then they either do or don't come and get it, but we've already counted as being checked out.
Is that a big deal?
That's up to you.
I don't know.
Clock starts.
So, well, I think your staff has really, you know, when I sat on the committee with them, they all have really good ideas, and mm-hmm. they're the ones that are dealing with the mm-hmm. everyday questions and having, mm-hmm. so I think it'd be really helpful to see what they have, if they have something to bring to the table. I think, mm-hmm. you know, at this point, I think we're all open to hearing if there are some, yeah. you know, changes that maybe, oh. because, yes, you know, technology and everything's changing, and communities, and, like, is it the smaller, I understand that, you know, and mm-hmm. you see that with companies and churches, and, you know, so I'm sure it's going to trickle down to those places, so, too.
It's going to end up basically where a community that has a small library and it needs fixing, are they willing to fix that, or would they rather put the money into a locker system? Mm-hmm. But we must have communities out there that are a lot larger in population today that don't have a library.
Right.
And then we would make that available to them, too, if they so want it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I don't mean... What is the, I mean, you know, I look at Albany's got one, Sauk Center's got one, Melrose has got one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are 3,000 to, 5,000 people in them cities.
Mm-hmm.
I don't foresee them type of cities, but,
no.
you know, you maybe have the Uppsala, the Gray Eagles that are very small and the budget is constrained.
Mm-hmm.
And they got a lot of other needs for the budget, but are they willing to go and put money into
right
into they would the have library or into a locker system.
Yeah.
In Carver County, a charter school was built in Cologne. It's a pretty small town.
Mm-hmm.
And they partnered with, I believe, is the city and the library system for a locker. And that was their library.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was well utilized, not just by the school, but the whole
everybody.
Community. I could send books there if I wanted to pick up. So it was just really, it was just a bigger partnership than you think. It's
yeah.
not just
yeah.
for this. It's the community.
That's
at
part
large.
Of Carver County. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Okay.
It's the Melsa.
Yeah.
yeah.
That's a tough conversation to have. Or
it
who's
is.
Going to initiate the conversation? I mean, you almost got to wait for the city.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That would be my thought.
But when it becomes a safety issue, like a health hazard,
yeah,
happens
yeah.
Later.
I mean,
yeah.
they got to realize mm-hmm. that.
Yeah.
Or do they have the facts by something like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like I said, there are a couple tiny libraries right now that I'm really concerned about. Mm-hmm. And the cities have been trying to fix it. But they're just really old buildings that have structural challenges.
Uh-huh.
It's not that the cities aren't being good partners. They're being really good partners. But I don't know that they have the resources to make a significant enough change there. So again, I just wanted to know, what's our latitude when we meet next week? And it sounds like you're up and bring back what makes sense.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
I like flexibility.
And I think
to the Maple Lake Library.
Right? They've managed a lot.
And to Tina's comment, mm-hmm. there might be some out there that want to have a locker system and they could
mm-hmm.
afford
mm-hmm.
through the system. So maybe yeah. we got that policy now.
Yep.
So I would definitely keep that policy.
Mm-hmm. All right. Wonderful. Well, Cindy and Aref, we have our marching orders. Awesome. Thank you all very much. I really appreciate it. I know these are big, meaty issues.
Anything else on that?
Nope. I think that's all I had for tonight. I think that's enough.
Next meeting is September 15th, and that'll
yep.
be a regular board meeting.
Yep, and we probably will have a finance committee on the September 15th. And personnel. Okay.
We will.
I believe so. Yeah, most likely. All right. Well, thank you all. I appreciate you all stretching your brains this evening with us to kind of talk through some of these thorny issues.
Thank you very much for your time.